Today marks 5 years since Benedict XVI was elected Pope, but the mood at the Vatican is not very festive. Benedict is at the center of a mounting scandal over pedophile priests. The weekly National Catholic Reporter is calling this the largest institutional crisis in centuries. The Pope met with sex abuse victims in Malta on Sunday, but critics are calling for more concrete action. NPR's Silvia Poggioli looks at the impact of the crisis.
When elected Pope, Benedict was not an outsider. As Cardinal Joseph Ratzinger, he had spent nearly a quarter of a century as the Vatican's top enforcer of doctrine. Sandro Magister, a widely read Vatican analyst, explains what Benedict sees as the focus of his papacy.
His priority is to bring God back into the lives of men and bring humanity back on the road to God. And he does this through his sermons, his encyclicals, and his books about Jesus. Words are the essence of this papacy.
Benedict is more bookish theologian than administrator. His style is remote, and he's surrounded by a few loyal aides. Robert Mickens is the Vatican correspondent for the British Catholic weekly, The Tablet.
He's very much almost obsessed with secrecy, with keeping things out of the public eye. He doesn't like the fact that the dramas of the church or debates within theology are played out in the public press.
Benedict is not a good communicator. Some of his words have offended Muslims, Jews, and Anglicans. His rehabilitation of a Holocaust-denying bishop even angered some European government officials.
This is a papacy of permanent crisis.
Marco Politi is a veteran Vatican correspondent.
There was a crisis with the Islam world. There are repeated crises with the Jews all over the world. There has been the crisis with the public opinion about condom and AIDS. He lacks the temper, the style, as a leader always in contact with the public opinion. This is a failure of this papacy.
Swiss theologian Hans Kuhn.
I still hope this can be repaired if he would make an act of courageous reform.
King has known Joseph Ratzinger since they were young advisors at the Second Vatican Council in the 1960s that opened the church to the modern world. A longtime critic of his former colleague, King has written an open letter to the world's bishops with a long list of what he calls Benedict's missed opportunities.
He finally and especially missed the opportunity to make the spirit of the Second Vatican Council the compass for the whole church, including the Vatican itself, and thus to promote the needed reforms of the Catholic Church.
King urges bishops to push for reforms, even disobeying the Pope if necessary. The theologian blames Benedict for fostering an authoritarian system he says is endangering the Church. King claims the Vatican cover-up of clerical sex abuse cases was engineered by the Congregation for the Doctrine of the Faith under Cardinal Ratzinger.
With good reason. Many people today have expected a personal mea culpa of the former prefect and current pope, and instead he passed up the opportunity.
Analyst Sandro Magister disagrees.
Without a doubt, cases of sex abuse by some priests are being used directly to attack Pope Benedict and the Catholic Church. The battle that is being waged by the international media is not against pedophilia. Rather, it is a battle against the Catholic Church.
When he was elected Pope, Benedict stressed the need for a Christian revival in an increasingly secularized Europe. But recent clerical sex abuse revelations in Ireland, Germany, Austria, the Netherlands, and elsewhere seem to have further widened the gap between European Catholics and their church. The president of the Association of Young German Catholics, Dirk Tensler, said recently, "There's no such thing as a Generation Benedict." Young people, he said, have a different idea of how to live their lives. Silvia Poggioli, NPR News, Rome.
And in Washington, D.C., after a long battle to work out a new way of hiring and rewarding teachers, a tentative agreement is now in doubt. That contract had been hailed as a possible model for the rest of the country. NPR's Claudio Sanchez explains what happened.
After nearly 3 years of bitter contract negotiations, it appeared the Washington Teachers Union and school's chancellor, Michelle Rhee, had finally come to a groundbreaking agreement, announced with great fanfare on April 7th. A few days later, Rhee dropped not one, but two bombshells. Under questioning from city council members, she said her decision to lay off 266 teachers last fall was based on a multi-million-dollar budget deficit. That deficit, Rhee said, turned out to be inaccurate. In fact, she later learned there was a $34 million surplus. She blamed the confusion on the city's chief financial office, which immediately fired back, saying Rhee was wrong on both counts. George Parker, the president of the teachers' union, called for a news conference to say he was stunned and confused.
I think everyone is confused in terms of whether the money is there or the money is not there. That causes some doubt in terms of the credibility of the chancellor. And I think that's very, very disturbing.
After repeated requests, Rhee declined to speak to NPR. But in a written statement, she insisted that she had been reassured there was a surplus in the school budget. Union leaders say their pending contract with Rhee is on hold and that they cannot trust what she says anymore.
It is an appalling lack of judgment and leadership.
Randy Weingarten, president of the American Federation of Teachers, helped negotiate the D.C. teachers' contract with Rhee.
You can't run a school system that way. And ultimately, everybody has to be accountable in terms of making sure that this system works.
To that end, the teachers' union wants resolution on three fronts. One, it wants a D.C. Superior Court judge to reopen a lawsuit demanding that Rhee reinstate the 266 teachers she laid off in light of Rhee's admission that they were fired based on inaccurate budget information. Second, the union also wants the city's chief financial officer to clarify once and for all if the school district is running a deficit or a surplus. And third, union leaders want teachers to ratify the contract.
But we can't vote to ratify that contract until we are certain that the District of Columbia public school budget can fully fund it.
Veteran teachers who've been trying to follow all this don't know if they should be surprised, angry, sad.
Well, it's embarrassing.
Fraser O'Leary has been a high school social studies teacher in D.C. for 40 years.
We want to have a first-class school system. We want to be recognized as, I'm sure, what the chancellor wants us to be and what the union wants us to be. And reform is needed. But reform without trust doesn't work.
And that, says O'Leary, is the sad lesson here. A historic contract, a breakthrough in the way teachers are compensated that puts performance ahead of seniority and compensates teachers based on students' achievement, is hanging by a thread because somebody got their math wrong. Claudia Sanchez, NPR News.
We're taking time this April to savor poetry in honor of National Poetry Month. Today, an anthology of African-American nature poems called Black Nature. While putting the book together, poet Camille T. Dungy pored over verse going back to the 1700s. She opens the collection with a late 20th century poem by Lucille Clifton, read here by Camille Dungy.
Surely I am able to write poems celebrating grass and how the blue in the sky can flow green or red, and the waters lean against the Chesapeake shore like a familiar. Poems about nature and landscapes, surely. But whenever I begin, the trees wave their knotted branches, and why is there under that poem always an other poem?
Camille Dungy calls this collection of nature poetry by African Americans a first of its kind. She says black poets are rarely thought of as writing in a genre that can bring to mind the leisure, the time to contemplate, say, fields of flowers.
The way that the tradition of nature poetry has taken off in America in particular is often about a pastoral landscape, a very certain idealized rural landscape, or a wilderness landscape in which people aren't involved. And black people have been typically working in the land, and that's not part of the idyllic version of things. And then also, the majority of African Americans have tended to live in urban landscapes. And so there's a very different view quite often of the natural world.
There are poems in here that speak of a slave past, and some, in fact, written by slaves. This one by Marilyn Nelson has this sort of lovely and sad line. It's about the peanut, which is,
yes,
Arachis hypogea. And I'll just read it. Arrakis hypogea may have been smuggled to North America by slaves who had seeds of survival in their hair. What do you make of that image, seeds of survival?
As the poem moves further, it says promise and purpose, the ancestor's dream, right? That so much of what the peanut, the sweet potato or yam, the cultivation of greens, there's so many things that were about sustenance that if we look at history and say, well, Black people can only write about the natural world and think about slavery or think about being a runaway, you forget that other component, that there has always been promise and survival in the natural world, that some people knew where to look and how to look. And so that is as much a part of these poems, the hope and the potential for a real connection and collaboration is there as much as this devastating and horrible history is there.
There's a view of nature, quite sweet, even quite silly. It's a haiku by Richard Wright.
Coming from the woods, a bull has a lilac sprig dangling from a horn.
It's such a lovely little moment.
Right, the sort of comic look of this giant, potentially really violent creature with this sort of dopey, glorious little lilac sprig and the beautiful smell of the lilac next to the probably not so beautiful smell of the bull. It's just so much contradiction right there. And the world that's being described throughout this book has that same breath of possibility in terms of what direction we might go from sadness to joy. And sometimes from line to line, we move through that.
There was one poem that had me laughing my head off. It's called Ambition 2, Mosquitoes in the Mist. It's by the poet Tim Siebels. Would you read the first two stanzas and we'll sort of get
sure.
the idea?
You human types, you two-legged sapiens, you guys are walking smoothies to me. Milkshakes wearing trousers, a cup of coffee mowing a lawn. I gotta hand it to you, though. All the colors, the smells, tall, petite, skinny minis, or whopping whale-sized Mother Humphreys. You got variety. I'm zipping around some summer nights, and it's like an all-you-can-eat situation.
And it goes on, but there's another quite amusing one which would not seem immediately about nature. It's structured as a classified ad in the newspaper.
Yes, it's Evie Shockley's poem, 31 Words, Prose Poems, number 12. Highly visual rural winter image seeks lyric poem, 14 to 30 lines, for mutual enrichment and long-term relationship. Image offers frostbitten river and fog-covered fields where snow seems to rise toward its origins.
Wow.
And another thing that a lot of these poems do is they really sort of consciously remind you of what some of the expectations for what a nature poem is and kind of makes us rethink what it means to be Black and how we might see the world. And so poems like this, I think, are really fun in that you come at them thinking one thing and you leave thinking another.
You end this collection in a gentle way, for the most part. There's a beautiful one by Anne Spencer. It's called Earth, I Thank You.
Yes. Anne Spencer was a civil rights activist. She was the librarian for the Black Library because in the town of Lynchburg, Virginia, it was in the deed that African Americans could not go into the building. And so she was the librarian for the African Americans in the town. She was working against a lot of arbitrary racism. But at the same time, she had this incredible garden in her backyard. And she was also aware of this other kind of peace and beauty. Earth, I thank you. Earth, I thank you for the pleasure of your language. You've had a hard time bringing it to me from the ground, to grunt through the noun, to the all the way feeling, seeing, smelling, touching, awareness. I am here.
Poet Camille T. Dungy, she edited the new anthology Black Nature, Four Centuries of African American Nature Poetry. Thanks very much for joining us.
Thank you for having me, Renee.
And you can read her poem, Language, at our website, npr.org. Tomorrow, Poems for the Awkward Years, a new collection for tweens. This is Morning Edition from NPR News. I'm Renee Montaigne.
And I'm Steve Inskeep. President Obama will be in California today, and the president is expected to push for regulation of financial institutions. There is a bill with new regulations before the Senate. Joining us now, as she does most Mondays, is NPR's Cokie Roberts. She is at member station KUT in Austin, Texas. Hi, Cokie.
Good morning, Steve.
You know, in the past, the president has mocked Republican opposition, kind of had some humor at their expense. But in his radio address on Saturday, he struck a very different tone. He called his opponents cynical and deceptive. What's happening here?
Well, Republican leader Mitch McConnell has been saying repeatedly that the bill that's designed to better regulate financial institutions is a bailout bill. And Republicans all over the Hill have been saying that word, bailout, bailout, bailout. And, of course, that's a very charged word since we have bailed out those big Wall Street firms, which are now making scads and scads of money. So the White House feels like it's got a fight back and saying it's not even vaguely true that this is a bailout. They sent Secretary of the Treasury Tim Geithner out yesterday to make the case for the bill. Here he is on NBC's Meet the Press.
I am very confident that we're going to have the votes for a strong package of financial reforms that will bring derivative markets out of the dark, help protect taxpayers from having to fund future bailouts, and trying to make sure we're giving Americans some basic protection against fraud and abuse.
Geithner says he's sure we will have a bill and have Republican support for it. That'll be interesting to see. Over the weekend, the White House did suggest changing the legislation to take out a bank-financed pool that was designed to help shut down failing institutions, because that's the element of the bill the Republicans have been calling the bailout.
Okay, so the Republicans are describing this as a bailout. Democrats are basically saying Republicans have been meeting with Wall Street executives and trying to block regulation here.
Well, Mitch McConnell and Texas Senator John Cornyn, who's head of the Republican campaign committee for the Senate, did apparently meet with Wall Street leaders. But McConnell repeatedly said yesterday on CNN that Kentucky bankers, his home state, are against this bill, too. The little guys, not just the big guys. And he pointed out that Wall Street supported Barack Obama in 2008, which is, in fact, true. Look, Steve, if the Democrats can't make the case that the Republicans are the party of Wall Street and big business, then it shows that the Democrats really have lost one of their key arguments. I mean, that has been their argument since Herbert Hoover's time, and it's worked very well for them, particularly worked well for them in 2008. So the fact that the president is using this kind of rhetoric shows them that they're afraid that they might be losing the voters on their key issue.
Does it affect the debate over this financial regulation that even as the Senate prepares to take it up, Goldman Sachs is accused of wrongdoing?
Well, yeah, the Democrats think it does help. The fact that Goldman has been charged with defrauding its investors, and now European countries are apparently taking a look at it to see whether they want to bring charges against Goldman as well, and maybe some other firms as well. People start to remember why this bill is important, why you have to regulate these financial institutions and their complicated maneuverings. And McConnell was very clear yesterday in saying everybody wants a bill. There's not one member of the Senate that doesn't want a bill, he kept saying. He just kept saying he wants to go back to the table and start again with a bipartisan bill. Does that sound familiar to you,
Sounds
Steve?
Like almost word to word, the health care bill, same thing.
Exactly. But it also is polling pretty well with the voters, that idea of a bipartisan bill.
Well, since you mentioned polls, that leads to the question of elections. We've got one coming up. And what do you think it means, Cokie Roberts, that the president needs to go to California and campaign for Senator Barbara Boxer?
Well, if Democrats are having trouble in California, they're having trouble everywhere. And they're particularly having trouble with independent voters. And so I think that is going to be trouble for the president on the campaign trail now that he's hitting it, because, of course, he does need to hit a bipartisan tone for those independents. But once you're out on the trail, it's the base you need to rev up. And you stop talking in a bipartisan way. And I think that that's likely to happen now. Now, perhaps the president has decided that he's not going to get any Republican support anyway, and he might as well get Democrats excited. That's what George Bush found after he tried to do things in a bipartisan manner. Barack Obama seems to be finding the same thing.
Okay, thanks very much. That's analysis on this Monday morning from NPR's Cokie Roberts. You hear from her every Monday, and we'll continue covering the financial regulation and other stories on NPR News.